Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome Mark Shapiro. He is the author of the book Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power, published by Chelsea Green Publishing. This book is in large part about the contrast between Europe and the United States and the way in which we deal with environmental protection. Describe where we are in relation to Europe. What are the differences in the approach that we take to regulating and protecting people from the toxic materials in our world?
Well, that is a very good question and a central question. The United States, really over the past 7 or 8 years, has fallen behind what most of the world is doing when it comes to environmental protection. So now here in the United States, we have, I've looked at a number of elements to this in my book, one of which, a major part of which, is the question of chemicals. How do we handle chemicals in everyday products and such? And what I found out was that the United States permits an incredible array of substances that are widely considered to be toxic substances to be used in everything from toys to automobiles to cosmetics. And those same products, the same exact products in Europe, for example, don't have those substances. So the European Union applies something called the precautionary principle. And they look at scientific evidence, and they basically look at accumulation of evidence. And if the evidence starts suggesting that there could be real harm from a substance, they require that it be removed. They ban it. In the United States, we do not have the precautionary principle. We have a system that essentially has to definitively prove the toxic qualities of a particular chemical. And when I say definitively, I mean definitively prove in the realm of science, as many of your listeners probably know, is a near impossibility. Science is itself a fantastic enterprise where one conclusion leads to another question, leads to another conclusion, and on and on. And so the United States, however, has created this almost impossible barrier to meet of proving definite harm before being able to act, as well as a number of other things such as cost benefit, or the benefits greater than the cost, et cetera, et cetera. So the result is that in product after product, you've got highly toxic chemicals. I mean, we're seeing, you know, things like phthalates in children's toys that are endocrine disruptors, are used in toys that children can suck on, allowed to be used here in the U.S., banned in Europe. Other substances that are carcinogenic substances in cosmetics, banned in Europe, allowed to be used in the United States. And one after the other, and I talk about this in my book, we've got a situation where Americans are being exposed to toxic substances that the rest of the world, much of the world, and most of the developed world is following the Europeans' lead now, are protected from.
You describe a double standard in which large American companies complying with European regulations in Europe are still making the argument that the same standards are overly burdensome when similar regulatory legislation is introduced in the U.S.
Exactly. And in my book, I describe going to the headquarters of a major multinational cosmetic company. And I went to the research center for a major cosmetic company based in its European operations based in Brussels. And listened to them as they told me how they were taking toxic substances out of their cosmetics. The Europeans had passed a law requiring that chemicals that cause cancer, that mutate genes, and that disrupt the reproductive system be removed from cosmetics. Now, who knew there were such chemicals in cosmetics to begin with? We certainly had very little idea here in the United States that such chemicals were in hundreds and hundreds of cosmetic products. And one of the ways we learned that, or I learned that, and any consumer can learn it as well, is because the Europeans published a list. And they published a list of chemicals that are forbidden to be used in cosmetics sold in Europe. And that list contains hundreds of substances that are either carcinogens, mutagens, or reproductive toxins. So I'm there in this very nice research center for this big, large company, and they're telling me that they are adapting to this situation because they have a huge European market. And so what have they been doing? They've been taking chemicals out of their cosmetics. And then a couple of weeks later, I fly back to California. I live in California, and I went to a hearing at the California State Senate where a bill had been introduced to essentially require cosmetic companies to tell the state what kind of chemicals they had in their cosmetics. And this very same company was one of the top lobbying forces in the state capitol, fighting a measure that was essentially a tenth as strong as the Europeans' measure. So within the same, essentially, like six-week period, you had two very different approaches being taken by one company. So what we're seeing is this kind of emergence of a double standard when it comes to environmental protection.
Where is the United States Food and Drug Administration on the safety of cosmetics?
Well, the Food and Drug Administration basically does not exist on the question of safety of cosmetics.
Is there anybody that regulates the safety of cosmetics and creams and all this stuff that we, especially women, put on ourselves?
Well, the FDA has some limited power to look at hair dyes. That's the one area that they do have some power in. But when it comes to the 95% of other cosmetic products, the cosmetic industry has no independent body overseeing their operations. So these substances that you apply to your skin and to your body and such, basically nobody, I think most women, not to mention men, might presume that somebody has certified the safety of these products before they go on the shelf. And that is incorrect. It's an illusion. And I think it's an illusion that many Americans share, partly because we like to think we have faith in our government and they're looking out for our interests. But I think on the questions of chemicals in these and other products, that is absolutely not the case. So when it comes to cosmetics, the industry, when this was raised, and it has been raised several times over the 60, 70 years existence of the FDA, when there have been efforts to regulate the ingredients in cosmetics, the cosmetic industry has repeatedly fought those efforts back and instead said that they would regulate themselves. So what you now have is a situation where the Cosmetic Trade Association, Cosmetic Fragrance and Trade Association, basically sponsors a meeting every couple months of scientists who are supposed to be looking at the ingredients in cosmetics and providing recommendations to companies as to whether or not they should use them. Now, that sounds fine, except when you realize that, number one, this is nothing but a recommendation, and I have numerous examples in my book and elsewhere of recommendations made by the industry's own scientists where the industry has not responded. And two, compare that to what happens in the European Union. In the European Union, every quarter, a group of scientists meet from toxicological institutes across Europe, and they assess the toxicity of certain of the substances. They determine what is and what is not toxic, and that goes straight into the governing authorities in the European Union, which act to either put it or remove it from the negative list, which is of prohibited substances. So you have very, very different systems at work in these two places that are basically the same economic affluence level and such like that, extremely different systems at work. And the result is that I think Europeans are far more protected than Americans from substances, many of which are sold by the same companies.
One thing that's very worrisome is that because a lot of the products that are made in the United States cannot even be allowed to be sold in Europe because they don't meet European standards, does that mean that we are the only market for them and therefore we are basically the guinea pigs for these toxic products?
Well, that, I'm afraid, is indeed what's happening. Is indeed what's happening because the European Union has passed these laws. It's cosmetics, it's toys, it's automobiles, it's electronic devices, thousands and thousands of things that we engage with on a daily basis. And so where are you going to go when you can't hold on to this market of almost 500 million people? Where are you going to come to the United States? And we're seeing a lot of these. This is a very powerful example, I think. We just went through this whole difficult couple of weeks here with the lead, with the recall of toys. And, of course, that kind of shines a light on this whole question. What I think is interesting is to consider the toxic substances that we knowingly allow to come into the United States. So this was kind of ostensibly a surprise in terms of discovering that there was lead in toys, but every day we're allowing toys in with substances that we know are toxic, and that includes phthalates. So phthalates are a substance that softens plastic, and for kids, it makes it very soft and pliable so kids can bounce it around and suck on it and just have fun with little toy giraffes and
rubber
like that.
Rubber duckies and whatnot.
Rubber duckies, yeah, the ultimate rubber ducky, right. So a mounting body of evidence suggests that phthalates, what do they do in the first year or two after birth? Well, they decrease the production of testosterone, which you don't have to be a scientist to figure out that it's not something you want decreased early in life, and has an effect on essentially the development of the sexual reproductive system of young males. So the European Union has looked at a stream of evidence for some years now, and about 6 or 7 years ago, banned the use of phthalates in toys. So you go to Europe, no phthalates in toys. They don't exist. Then in the industries have found alternatives. The United States looked at essentially the same evidence, because much of this evidence comes from international research institutions, many of which are located here in the United States. So they look at the same evidence. The American authorities are looking at all this abundance of evidence, and the European authorities are looking at this abundance of evidence, and the United States decided to do nothing about phthalates. So what you have is a situation where I've been following confiscations in European customs authorities. And every week, the European Union reports the products that they've confiscated from the shelves of European retail outlets. And among them, every month at least, is a confiscation of toys from China with phthalates. And I can tell you, they describe last July, there was a shipment of toy hippopotamus that was confiscated from the stores in Lithuania. And there it is, confiscated, taken right off the shelves, and said, we don't permit this substance to be sold within the European Union. So that product's been recalled in Europe. Now, where do you think that's going to go?
Perhaps to Walmart?
Could be. This is where the market is. The United States, as well as all the other countries that don't regulate phthalates, which would be places with far less even regulatory, Cameroon and, you know, places with no regulatory protections at all. So we're in the situation now of basically becoming a dumping ground for products that are being refused elsewhere around the world.
One interesting point in your book is that a real difference between the United States and European systems is that we have a heavier reliance on the judicial system to essentially effect regulation through the process of lawsuits. Does this work for things like toxins and environmental toxins?
Well, that is very interesting, and there is something at the heart of the differences in Europe and America. What the United States has is a very lively tort system. So you can file lawsuits when there are problems with products and allege that a company caused harm. Two things about that situation. Number one, and that is true, and an enormous amount of progress has been made as a result of lawsuits. DES and Ford's engines and the Vioxx cases now are going through the courts. But number one, at the heart of that question is dealing with the problem after it surfaces. It takes an enormous amount of effort to prove in a court of law the toxic effects of a particular substance. So basically, at the heart of that approach, it causes punishment to a company or a producer of these problems after the fact, number one. Number two, the European Union is a very different approach. They take their precautionary principle approach. They do not have a lively tort system. They do not have an ability to catch major damages from companies that are creating products that cause damage. And instead, what their approach has been is precautionary. They try to have the government move in before a problem surfaces.
And so they'd rather prevent the problem than than have a lawsuit once the person is maimed or sick.
Right, right. They try to prevent the problem from surfacing to begin with, and that is at the heart of our different approaches, is the Europeans try to prevent the problem before it surfaces, and the Americans have the ability to punish once a problem has gotten so bad that numerous people have already been damaged by it. Now, there's an interesting twist to that tale, because when I spoke to company representatives in Europe who were the European representatives for American multinationals operating in Europe, I asked them explicitly, I said, well, why does your company oppose laws back home in the United States that it is clearly willing to adapt to here in Europe? And the answer came back, and it came back numerous times. It was so interesting how many times it was repeated. It basically came back saying, well, we don't need those kind of laws, this strict regulation in the United States, because we have this tort system. And if we produce a product that is dangerous, we will be brought into court. It will cost us billions of dollars, and our shareholders don't like that to happen. That is what I heard numerous times. Then I came back and I started kind of checking around, because I was interested about that argument, and I began looking into the tort reform movement. And some of you listeners might be aware of this movement to essentially reform the American civil litigation system. And that effort is targeted at this exact system that I'm talking about, which is the ability to bring corporations to court to pay damages for products that cause harm to individuals. And it's now called the tort reform movement. What did I find out? Well, I found out that the same companies whose European representatives were telling me that the important difference with America was that they had this tort system, so we don't need these kind of regulations. When I came back to the United States and I did some reporting, I found out that many of those same companies are significant contributors to the tort reform movement here in the United States. So what you get, again, is a dual universe where the word or the line or the explanation in this case is we don't need tight regulation because we've got the tort system. And then with its other hands, with its political PACs and such like that, some of these very companies are funding the effort to dismantle that legal system.
You wrote a book called Circle of Poison, co-wrote this book about 25 years ago, in which you exposed the situation of the United States exporting toxic chemicals, pesticides, and so on, which had been banned in the United States, exporting those to other countries, third world countries with lower environmental standards. Now we're in almost the opposite situation in which some of our standards are far behind not only European countries, but even Mexico and some African countries.
Yeah, you know, it's incredible. It's incredible. There's been such an incredible retreat from environmental protection under the current administration that we are falling behind not only Europe, but other countries around the world, which are really trying to take seriously their environmental problems. We've had here in the United States drastic cutbacks in the enforcement ability of EPA and the enforcement ability of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, as we saw with the lead and toy fiasco. And while we're doing that, while we're completely abnegating a role of environmental leadership, the rest of the world is moving ahead. They're not waiting. So you have actually situations where the country of Mexico, and this happened about a year ago, banned a pesticide called lindane, which was actually quite legal here in the United States. And the United States finally actually caught up with Mexico, but actually ended up following Mexico. And it was amazing, actually. I talked to some Mexicans when it came to lindane. It's a very potent neurotoxic chemical that the Mexicans decided to ban about 2 years ago. And they were telling me that their biggest concern was that there would be smuggled lindane into Mexico from the United States.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so they were worried about smuggling from, well, from New Mexico and in Arizona and the border states in California into Mexico. So that was quite a flip on the head from the role that most Americans presume themselves to be in the world. And all across the board, what you're seeing, for example, in electronics is the European Union has banned numerous chemicals from being used in electronics, very highly toxic metals and chemicals, flame retardants.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is a very interesting difference. The European response to the toxins in electronics and in cars and so on has been to require a life cycle analysis of any product brought to market. What is this? How does it work?
Life cycle analysis really is, I kind of love the term. I thought it was kind of some Zen Buddhist thing that I hadn't quite understood when I first heard about it. But and perhaps it is in that practice, but it's also, in this case, a ability to understand what the life cycle of a product is. So basically, it's produced, and it is the traditional way to do it in the United States is you produce something, you use it for 10 years, And then you throw it in the trash, and then it's out of mind. But actually where it ends up is in some big dump somewhere, poisoning somebody with what's inside the console or the electronic circuitry or whatever it is. So life cycle is really trying to look at they call it cradle to cradle, which is essentially how can we produce a product that both you can, when you buy it, when you use it, and then you use it over a period of time, and that it integrates so many elements of itself that are kind of recyclable that significant portions of that product can be recycled, and that those that cannot be recycled will not at the very least be toxic. So what they're looking at is the long-term environmental and economic costs of traditional production. So traditional production in the United States, basically enormous amount of money goes into innovation and research. You come up with a new product, you get it onto the market, and then you don't worry about the cost 10, 20, 30 years down the line when the toxic components of that product begin to leach into the water and into the air and into the soil.
So are European producers then responsible? Let's say I'm a European television or computer producer. Am I then responsible for the disposal of that product?
Yes, that's the striking thing. There's a whole life cycle take-back program, exactly as you described, which is basically major electronics firms that produce everything from DVD players to televisions to computer monitors, printers. They are obligated to set up little stations at retail outlets across Europe where they are required to take back their products at the end of their usable lifespan. And once they do that, they then are obligated to recycle the components of those substances, which gives a very, very, very powerful incentive to develop new materials that can be recycled. It's an extremely, been a very powerful incentive prompting new ingenuity and new innovation on how to deal with materials and come up with more environmentally benevolent materials. Now, here in the United States, what's interesting about that is the major electronics firms, of course, are doing that, exactly that. And you go into any major retail outlet and you'll see a little take-back station at the back of the store. And the same thing applies to automobiles. Automobile manufacturers are now under the obligation to have 85% of the insides of the automobile to be recyclable. And the European Union has also banned the use of certain chemicals in automobiles, including cadmium and chromium and lead and mercury and a couple of other ones. So when you own an automobile, you drive it in, and the manufacturer is obligated to dispose of it for you in an environmentally safe fashion. Well, here, and we're talking about many of the same automobile companies, because automobile companies are international, as are the electronics firms. They set up these stations in Europe, and it's working very effectively. In the United States, those industries have resisted every step of the way setting up that kind of recycling operation. And my point in the book is to demonstrate how such programs can work and are working, and to take on directly the economic argument here that these things are unreasonable and unfeasible. And I show in cases like the one just described how what is being told, what Americans are being told is unrealistic, is exactly what's happening in an economy and in a population that is as comparable to our own as you could possibly get.
Tell us about the 1976 Toxic Substances Control Act here in the United States. What did it do and what did it not do?
Boy, that's a huge question. And what's called TSCA, let's call it TSCA, Toxic Substances Control Act, those were in the days when actually the United States was at the lead of, and even was at the environmental lead in the world at that time, back in the 1970s. And we were the first country to pass a law regulating chemicals, really pretty much anywhere in the world. You'd had this profusion of chemicals come into the marketplace after World War II that had not been looked at. Nobody really understood what they were. And so this was the first law to really begin to analyze chemicals. However, that law, which was passed in 76 and took effect in 1981, basically exempted all existing chemicals on the market from testing. So basically what you had, it sounds really great, we were the first country to do it, but basically it exempted all chemicals that are already being sold on the market were exempted, and its requirements for testing applied only to chemicals that were introduced from 1981 on. So what do we have 25 years later? Is we have some 90% of the chemicals on the market today have never been tested, have never been assessed for their toxicity, have never gone through the rigorous testing that TSCA requires for new chemicals. Why? Because the chemical industry figured, well, if we can just get away with having a bunch of old chemicals on the market, we don't have to innovate and develop any new chemicals. So that's what's happened. And that's one of the reasons the United States is now falling seriously behind Europe and other parts of the world, because our chemical industry has been under no obligation to innovate less toxic alternatives. Now, what happened in Europe? The Europeans looked at this situation back in the 70s. This is why my book has the subhead, and what's at stake for American power, because I think this issue of environmental health really ultimately gets down to questions of power and how you act on the harms we clearly face. So the European Union, which had itself modeled its own chemical programs on the TSCA program in the United States when the U.S. was the clear leader in the world, began looking at the flaws of this system and began looking at these skyrocketing rates of breast cancer, skyrocketing rates of infertility among young women, of endocrine-disrupting conditions, and began drawing some links with the chemicals that are now in the marketplace. And so they basically imposed a law, which actually took effect last June, which is called REACH, R-E-A-C-H, and it's a long, it stands for something long, and I won't go into it.
Registration, Evaluation, and Authorization of Chemicals.
Thank you. You did that very elegantly. So this law, which you so eloquently just flew off your tongue, now is in effect in Europe, and there's an office in Helsinki, Finland, that is now requiring chemical manufacturers that want to sell chemicals and products that contain chemicals in Europe that must now be submitted for registration and assessment of their toxic qualities. And if they turn out to be potent endocrine disruptors or carcinogens, there are mechanisms at work to phase them off the market. So now suddenly you have a situation where the European Union has gone much, much further than the United States. We are left with an old archaic system, which has not stimulated innovation or promoted kind of new ideas in chemistry at all. And the Europeans are rapidly moving ahead of us in that area. And the other thing is that many other countries are now following the principles of the European REACH approach. For example, even in China, we all hear a lot about China and the devastating environmental conditions in China. I'm certainly not going to argue that that's not the case. But when it comes to production and chemical production, because China is now such a huge production center, they too are having to adapt the REACH proposals to their own chemical industry because they need to keep selling things to Europe. So in addition to China, places like Korea, places like Japan, places like Australia, even places like Mexico are beginning to integrate elements of the REACH concept into their own regulatory structures. And what that's doing is isolating the United States and the world with a kind of an old-fashioned system that does not really respond to the knowledge we now have about the potential dangers of chemicals.
And it does make you shudder to think what you have in the cabinet under your kitchen sink and in the bathroom. Let's move on to the question of genetically modified foods. There's been a robust movement in Europe against them, and you describe in your book an amazing moment in which French farmers go to fields planted with Monsanto genetically modified corn. They rip it out from the roots. But even more amazing than that scene was what happened to them when they were prosecuted.
That was an extraordinary scene. And you basically have a grassroots movement of farmers all around Europe, and it's basically centered in France, but it emanates from there, of farmers who are resisting actively the spread of genetically modified seed into their agricultural growing regions. So Americans basically don't hear about these very much, but really on a weekly basis, you're having like even assaults against testing facilities for GMOs, large protests by farmers and consumers essentially all over Europe, basically saying, we don't want this technology, which has not been tested, planted right into our fields where we've been growing food for hundreds of years. So the French, this fantastic story where the southwest France, at one night in early August of 2006, some farmers went into a test facility run by Monsanto, the American company Monsanto, and it was a couple acres big, and just started tearing up the plants. And sort of tearing them up, and they're part of a group of activist farmers, all of whom are kind of small farmers, small to medium-sized farmers, and they call themselves, I won't give you the French because I'll botch the accent, but it's called the Collective of Voluntary Reapers. So they basically see themselves as going out and they do kind of preventive harvesting of crops is how they look at it, direct action. And in this case, before the genetically modified corn could reach fruition, they went into that field and tore up like hundreds and hundreds of plants. It was late at night. It was about midnight. It was quite a dramatic tale. And then what happened was interesting. They were very public about their act. They gave their names. They didn't try to hide. And sure enough, they were arrested. It was about 42 farmers. And they had an argument in court about this was in Orleans in France. And the verdict that came down was an extraordinary verdict because the judge accepted what it was that the farmers had argued. And they'd argued that they had engaged in an act of civil disobedience to protect a system that they had relied on for their lives for centuries.
It was like self-defense.
Self-defense, exactly. That they were engaged in an act of self-defense against a new technology that threatened to destroy their way of life. And this was an extraordinary development. It had never happened before that somehow an attack on GMOs could be equated with an act of self-defense. But that, however, is really how many people see it. They perceive their kind of whole way of life, their whole agricultural system they take great pride in, as essentially being under assault by this kind of brand new technology being imported in by an American company. I mean, the striking thing was that this is an American company, and from St. Louis, from our own bread belt, moving American corn seeds into the center of French corn-growing region in the southwest of France, sort of between Orleans and Toulouse down there, beautiful, beautiful countryside, and attempting to sort of change the genetic configuration of a place where, you know, centuries and centuries of corn and other plants, a very abundant area, has been grown. So what you see is emerging an enormous tension around this area of genetically modified food, just like I described in the chemical area. And I describe this in some detail in the book about how this battle over genetically modified food has really become one of the central disputes or a central way to look at the different means by which Europeans and Americans approach these potential dangers.
Well, the part of the problem here is that the farmers are unable to protect their crops from contamination from genetically modified crops through cross-pollination. And the great contrast is farmers in Europe are actually compensated when their crops are contaminated, while in the United States and Canada, the farmers can be prosecuted.
Right. Yes. What I do is I look at the situation, and what the French farmers were worried about was that the pollen from these genetically modified corn would blow into their fields and contaminate their fields with genetic material they didn't want. And guess what? That exact phenomenon has happened here in the United States, where organic farmers, for example, find that their organic crops are basically contaminated with genetically modified corn seed that comes from a neighbor's farm, and there's absolutely nothing they can do about it. And in Europe, it's been happening increasingly, this idea of contamination. The French wanted to stop it. Now, how do the Europeans approach this question? Well, they have a system where if a farmer has their crops contaminated by GMOs, they can get compensation, because the Europeans acknowledge what that means. First of all, if you have GMO crops in France, there's almost nowhere you can sell your crop other than to be ground up into corn feed or something for an animal and maybe exported somewhere, because European consumers do not want genetically engineered ingredients, and many supermarkets don't even stock GE food.
And they require labeling, and we don't, so they at least know what they're eating.
Exactly. And they require, so everything that contains GE ingredients has to be labeled in a European supermarket. And here, that is not the case. And in fact, the industry has fought every step of the way to prevent that from happening, so that we don't even know whether we're buying GE ingredients or not.
So we have the American farmer in a very tricky position, because if they're growing organic crops, their crops can be contaminated. If they're growing genetically modified crops, they can't export them to anywhere. They have to be sold in the United States. That means farmers are in trouble, but also we American eaters are probably in trouble as well if we don't want to be eating genetically modified foods.
Well, you got it. What I wanted to look at is the economic implications of this irrational commitment to genetically engineered crops that I think has arisen here in the United States. So, but here's the crude economic reality, is that basically this technology is spread across America's farm belt. Some 60% of the corn in the U.S. is now GE corn, similar figures for soybeans, now wheat and other things coming up. So the problem is, where are you going to sell this stuff? It used to be that the European Union was one of the biggest markets in the world for American grain. I mean, literally, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of bushels, billions and billions of dollars of grain sent to Europe. And if you look, and I looked at the import-export statistics, that market has totally collapsed in the past 10 years. I mean, it's gone from hundreds of millions of bushels to something like 250 bushels within the span of 10 years. So there's been a total collapse of the export markets. What does that mean? That means we get increased stock here in the United States. All this stuff gets stuck in a silo somewhere and sits there until somebody buys it. Well, number one, who's going to buy it? Well, it's going to be us, number one. So we get more and more of this stuff. And two, it actually knocks the legs out from under the farmers in America, because there's so much abundance in the storage facilities that the price goes way down. And so it's caused both an economic crisis in American farm country, as well as a crisis for those who really want to avoid genetically modified food in America, and it's getting more and more difficult to do that.
You paint a picture of Europe as, in your words, a boisterous and disputatious and self-interested political organism. Are they having an effect on the United States, even if we're not necessarily paying as close attention as we should?
They're having an enormous impact on the United States because the laws they pass now apply to what has essentially become the world's largest economy. The United States used to be the world's largest economy, but that has ended. And that ended about really officially in 2005 when the European Union expanded to 25 different countries. Now it's 27. But people think of Brussels and the European Union as some quaint little funny little trade zone and funny little bureaucracy and little laws on sausages that are kind of bizarre. But in fact, that's a caricature. I always find this both funny and infuriating, the characterization of the European Union, because I spent a lot of time reporting from there. And this is a very powerful, organized political system that has the power to create laws in everything from civil liberties to financial questions, to competition law, to environmental law. And when a law comes out of Brussels that bans a certain substance or creates liability funds for genetically for farmers, that law becomes the law of the land for 27 different countries, representing 480 million people. And that means that the EU is now the largest market. It's about a third bigger than the United States is. So when these things come out of the EU, it's been causing enormous anxiety in corporate America. And the reason is that, to a great extent, manufacturers in the United States have essentially been operating under a system that they helped to write. They've been operating under rules that they have helped to write, and they've gotten very comfortable in this relatively kind of laissez-faire mode of operating. They have very little government oversight, and they can do what they want or produce according to standards that they themselves have helped to create. Now, suddenly, the EU is coming around and saying, wait a minute, we want to look at what the long-term impacts of these substances are. We want to establish principles of life cycle analysis. We want to take the most toxic substances in products. We want to take that stuff off the market. And there's a whole other array of things, including energy efficiency and stuff like that. So if you're in a multinational American company, suddenly, for the first time in history, you are having to pay attention to the proclamations of the laws of a foreign governing force to the extent you never have before. Because why? Because you want to hold on to that European market. So it's changed an enormous amount, and in some cases, some industries in America are adapting to the European standards. For example, big chunks of the electronics industry here, I think, are adapting to the European standards, at least when it comes to chemicals, not recycling, but chemicals.
Because they want to sell their products in Europe.
Exactly. But what that means, and even some of the big cosmetic companies are starting to adapt to some of the European laws as well. But what does that mean? That means, one, okay, good. Americans are the accidental beneficiaries of a law passed in another government, right? So we kind of accidentally get to benefit from that because this law was passed in Europe and maybe they're reformulating here in the United States as well. But two, it means that our own FDA and our own EPA has become totally irrelevant. We're talking about major, major, major American industries with, you know, representing hundreds of thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in investment and income here in the United States who no longer are paying attention to what our own regulatory agencies say because where the real action is in Brussels. So the United States in that way has painted itself into a corner whereby the steady deregulation and the steady retreat that we've seen over the past 6 or 7 years in this country, which might have provided very short-term benefit to profit levels, and I stress short-term because I don't think this is going to last, but in the process, that painted our own government into a position of irrelevance when it comes to these very significant questions of essentially what the rules are for production in the global economy.
Mark Shapiro, thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website Santa Fe Radio Cafe, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.